And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Flo Lloyd-Hughes. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. Adam Crafton is alongside me. The focus of today's pod is the takeover of Newcastle United by the Saudi Arabia-financed consortium. We'll discuss the big decisions that need to be made by the new owners, the future of Steve Bruce, January spending, and how to address the negative publicity surrounding the new owners and English football's obsession with money. So let's start by looking at what the change of ownership means for Newcastle United on the pitch. We're joined now by Chris Waff, who covers Newcastle for The Athletic and also co-hosts Pod on the Tyne. First things first, I think you have to say, really, what is it like being in the city since the takeover was announced?
There's just been a renewed vibe. I mean, we almost forget that sort of at the start of last week, Newcastle had just lost away at Wolverhampton Wanderers and had been awful, and it felt almost the lowest it's been, and that is saying something given how apathetic, angry, frustrated, disconnected Newcastle fans have felt for certainly the last few years, if not longer, under the Mike Ashley regime. And then by the end of the week, suddenly Mike Ashley is gone, the moment that I think many of them had come to think was possibly not going to happen, or certainly not in the short term. And also new ownership, Mike Ashley's gone, perhaps the future of the football club could look very, very different. And so there was wonderful scenes outside St. James's Park on Thursday, even before the news was confirmed, but the news was confirmed at 5:18 p.m. And there was flares going off, there was people drinking, it was just wonderful. And so many people that you've spoken to who have walked away from the club, there've been thousands and thousands of fans who have refused to go in the last few years in the Mike Ashley regime. You've got parents and children hugging and talking about being able to go back. And so from a purely footballing point of view, from that fact that fans have wanted this release of Mike Ashley going, it has just been, it just feels like there's a new energy.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I was watching some of those clips on Sky Sports News, which were just like chaos, basically. Has there been a kind of rise in ticket sales or shirt sales or anything like that with people saying, right, I'm ready to come back now because of this news?
Yeah, well, the game for Spurs on Sunday is now sold out. I think that that's the first time that Newcastle have sold out without having to give away 10,000 free half-season tickets during the second half of the 2019-20 season since Rafa Benitez was in charge. There's so many people who, anecdotally, but also in general, who you speak to, who have refused to go previously and now say they're going to be back. War flags, who you'll have seen previously if you've watched Newcastle games when there's been displays in the Gallagher End. Certainly, there was a Gallagher End-sized flag at one stage, various different displays. They stopped doing displays when Rafa Benitez left. They're going to be back on Sunday. They're planning an emergency display. So really, it is all change. And suddenly there is this renewed enthusiasm for the club and people feeling more connected to it than they had previously.
Chris, I suppose one of the things that's quite interesting is the way that these new owners are trying to connect with the fans. And, you know, there's some really easy wins, aren't there? Things like, let's have a meeting with Kevin Keegan. Let's have a meeting with Alan Shearer. It's almost at the point where you're waiting for the meeting with Anton Deck to come in and do the DJing in the stadium. What's your understanding? What do you expect them to, you know, where do you expect people like Keegan and Shearer to fit into this system? And also, what kind of manager do you think they want? Obviously, they've still got a manager in place at the moment in Steve Bruce. Many people are surprised he's still there given the takeover was completed last week. How quickly do you expect that to be resolved? And what kind of manager do they want to replace him?
I mean, in terms of addressing the first question, you refer to them as easy wins, and you're right, and I've referred to them as easy wins before, but also, I mean, it may seem to people elsewhere, why is that such an important point? But throughout a lot of the Mike Ashley era, club legends have not only been sort of distanced, they've not felt welcome, and Alan Shearer was manager for 8 games, then never received a phone call, even though Mike Ashley had basically decided with them that he was going to offer them the job for them to come back up, and then they haven't spoken since 2009. Kevin Keegan obviously won an employment tribunal against the club over unfair dismissal, and so those club legends haven't been back. And so to connect with them does seem like a PR move, and I'm sure it is in many ways, but also it means a heck of a lot to Newcastle fans, and those people should be involved. So I think we're looking at sort of ambassadorial roles potentially for them, or just being there on match day from time to time, being able to be presented on the pitch, something which hasn't happened basically throughout the Mike Ashley regime. In terms of the head coach, Steve Bruce, at the moment, as we speak at 10:09 this morning, he's due back at the training ground this afternoon. The players and him had a long weekend off. They were off Friday, Saturday, Sunday. He briefly spoke to Amanda Staveley over the phone on Thursday. So at the moment, he's due to take training, and then they're all meant to meet the new owners later. But we understand it's only a matter of time. I mean, there's a chance that by the time this podcast comes out that Bruce could be gone. We're not necessarily expecting it today, but over the next couple of days, Graham Jones probably in interim charge. Because part of the problem has been is because this has happened so quickly and because this has been going on for so long, there is no successor lined up. There are various names that they like. Each of the three elements of the consortium, you have to remember as well, there's quite a complex ownership group here. And so they all have different ideas as to what they want to do. Decisions take a bit of time. But in terms of my understanding of the sort of manager they like is what it's, how it's been put to me so far is a sort of club builder, almost someone who's going to help them progress to the next level. There's all of obviously the fantasy land that there's been of, is Kylian Mbappe going to sign? Is Harry Kane going to be here next week? But the reality is Newcastle United are second bottom of the Premier League. They haven't won a game this season in all competitions. They have regularly been in that position. They have deficiencies in various areas of the squad. They need someone who is going to, it's going to take time before they can even think about top eight, never mind anything beyond that. So they need someone who's going to build that. So I don't think we're likely to, Antonio Conte has been linked. I think that's unlikely. I think it's more likely to be someone younger, but not younger as in like their first or second job, someone who is more progressive, but who has got experience at the top level. That is the sort of what has been put to me is the likelihood of where they'll look.
And the reality is as well, like you said, there's actually a real urgency to change the situation. So looking at things now, obviously a few months until the transfer window opens in January, do you think realistically there is a good chance that Newcastle will stay up?
I think that they will, yes. I think even with the squad that they have, I think it's a false position, not in terms of results from the performances. They haven't, they've been playing more expansive football this year, but they concede a ridiculous amount of goals. They've conceded the joint highest number of goals. They do have deficiencies in certain areas. They've got a very unbalanced squad. They don't have enough goals in the team, and Callum Wilson's been injured too much. But there is enough in this squad that they shouldn't be down in the bottom three. They should have survived. I think that's where a lot of the frustration with Steve Bruce has come about with supporters as well, is that there's a belief that although this squad has limitations, it is better than being bottom six of the Premier League throughout basically the whole season. So I think that they will survive. And I also think in January, there will be money spent. I don't necessarily expect that to be an absolutely massive splurge. It's been put to me at the minute that the way they're looking at it maybe is there'll be sort of low tens of millions potentially spent, maybe on three or four key positions. They don't really have a left back. They've been playing Matt Ritchie, who's a right winger, as a left back. They need a left back. They need a dominant centre back, and they need a striker. I'd say they're the three positions key, probably a midfielder as well, if they're going to target in January. And I don't think it's going to be the transformative window then. January transfer windows are rarely conducive to that. It's a difficult window to work in anyway. More dramatic change tends to happen in the summer. So I think that they will look for upgrade signings, though, not signings who they're just going to want for 6 months. And then they're going to be signings who they want to help build the club. And so I think in January money will be spent, but I'm not expecting the entire first 11 is going to be different come the end of the January window.
Chris, I think it's quite interesting what you said about the it's obviously a complex ownership model that you have the Saudi fund, but then you also have Amanda Staveley with her percentage, Jamie Rubin with his percentage. Jamie Rubin was at QPR for a certain period of time, but you wouldn't say that these people are highly experienced in terms of working the transfer market, knowing agents, knowing people at clubs that you need to negotiate with, you know, sort of, I suppose, president to president kind of thing, as they say in Spain or Italy or Portugal. Who are the people, you know, or is it just still too early to know, but who do you think are likely to be the people that would actually be hands-on leading this recruitment? If I'm George Mendes, who's the person I need to call today to get a player into Newcastle in January? Yeah.
I think at the moment, one of the key appointments in my, or the two key appointments in my opinion they need to make beyond the manager are both a sort of CEO type. They don't really have someone in position there. Lee Charnley, who was the only director Newcastle had previously under Mike Ashley, the managing director, is staying on in an interim capacity. He's likely to be there for a few weeks, possibly a few months. But they don't have a sort of experienced football CEO from someone who's been in the Premier League or in Europe. And I think that that's a position they need to target, someone who can make the final decision or can streamline things and make sure that there is actually this someone who's fed into and can be the person who says, this is what we need to do next. This is how we're going to do it. So I think that, that's what they need to bring in. And my understanding is they are looking for someone as well. Also a sort of sporting director more, or a director of football, however, whichever model they decide to go down, someone who is then going to bring the sort of scouting expertise or have the team below them to be able to then progress that and decide this is the sort of head coach we're going to have. This is the sort of model we're going to have. These are the sort of players we need. This is the recruitment style we need. Their positions, which as of yet, Newcastle don't have. They have a head of recruitment in Steve Nixon, but really his forte is in youth recruitment. He hasn't been in that sort of experienced position across Europe to really suddenly go and try and compete with some of the best clubs for players. So at the moment, I think over the course of the next few weeks and months, as the club undergoes an internal review that the new owners want to put in place, I don't think that yet we are in a position to see exactly who they're going to go for in January. Certain players have been linked already, and there are players who they are interested in, but equally in terms of those actual specific, this is our shortlist, I think it's going to be a case of a few weeks before we get to that position, because those other people aren't in position. Amanda Staveley has her own football advisors. Jamie Rubin also has connections within the industry. And so at the minute, they have an agent and various sporting directors offering them players or saying, do you want X, Y, and Z? And there isn't really that streamlined way of deciding on that yet. And it's going to take a little bit of time until those people are in position.
I remember when Man City were taken over in 2008, there was a very, it was actually quite a similar situation, because they just had one day of the transfer window where they got Robinho in. And then they had this sort of 3-month build up to January. But there was a guy who was at Man City at the time there, who's called Suleiman Al-Fahim, who was the initial spokesman, I suppose, a bit like the role that Staveley's played over the past week in terms of being that initial voice of the club. And his approach was very, very different. He was saying things like, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo says he wants to play for the biggest club in the world. We'll see in January if that's really true when we make an offer and we're prepared to offer 135 million. And then we're going to sign Cesc Fabregas. Then we're going to sign Fernando Torres. After a few months, Suleiman Al-Fahim was removed from the club and, you know, has not been seen for quite a long time around football. But clearly, Amanda Staveley made some big promises last week in terms of, I think one of the back pages was saying, we'll be as big as City and PSG. You know, saying we want to win the title within 5 to 10 years. Do you think she struck the right tone in terms of the expectations that she laid out for the club?
I'll be honest, I was a little bit surprised by those sorts of comments. I didn't think that they would necessarily go as far as to say that, but equally, a lot of the things they've put on the website since has been about ambition. And although we haven't heard too much from the PIF beyond Yasser Al-Ramayan, who's going to be the non-executive chairman of Newcastle representative, he's the governor of the PIF. He released a statement, basically a welcoming to fans via the local newspaper last week, and he spoke about ambition as well. So clearly that is an element of what they want and what they want to do. But what I thought has been interesting, everything that Staveley has said beyond obviously those remarks have been about how this is going to take time and this is a building project. They don't want people to suddenly think that next summer or next season Newcastle United are going to be trying to qualify for the Champions League and competing for the Premier League, because they are light years behind even someone like Leicester City, never mind trying to compete with the likes of Man City and Liverpool and the squad that they have. It's not just about the first team. We've spoken about the other personnel who need to be brought in, but Newcastle's infrastructure just isn't there. The training ground is outdated, is needed changing for more than a decade. In 2013, when Joe Kinnear was director of football, he announced at that stage that Newcastle, the basically projects were now, Newcastle had planning permission for a new state-of-the-art training ground, which has never been built. So they're still in a training ground, which some of Steve McLaren's staff referred to as the squash club, because it's basically a converted sort of former youth club. It essentially is where it is. The stadium needs upgrading in many ways. The academy needs completely a lot of money put into it, because really that hasn't produced the players they need. So I think that she did strike the right tone. As I say, I was a little bit surprised by how hard she went on some things, but really that idea of it being a slow build and that we're a few years from Newcastle even thinking about competing with those sides is just the reality of the situation.
Obviously, Chris, you know the fans better than most. And I think as journalists, we do live in a bit of a bubble and a bit of a vacuum, where I think a lot of the stuff we see on social media is sort of toxic replies to articles our colleagues would have written about the obvious concerns around Saudi Arabia's human rights record. But would you say in the fan base there is a group, or there is, you know, a concern among fans, or would you say it is overwhelmingly positive right now?
I think it's nuanced, and I think that's what's difficult to sort of even answer this question, but also when sort of people externally look at the situation. I think the fact that there was so much outpouring of relief about the fact that Mike Ashley's gone, and I think that's where a lot of the excitement has come from. There is then also the obvious excitement about the fact that Newcastle United suddenly may become competitive over the course of the next few years, a club which hasn't won anything since 1969, hasn't won a domestic trophy since 1955. So there is real excitement about that. And there is this, and the fact that the new owners have come in, and as Adam said before, they've just, Amanda Staveley's come and spoken to supporters. They haven't had no one who's done that for the last 14 years. They've basically been ignored by him. And all of that, I think that there is, it is overwhelmingly positive, but I also think that a lot of people feel conflicted about the fact that now every single time that Newcastle United is mentioned, Saudi Arabia is going to be an asterisk alongside their name and the appalling human rights record that country has, and all of the other issues that come alongside that. And for some fans, I know, and this is anecdotally, it's very small, but I know of a few fans who basically say they don't want anything to do with the football club while the PIF, only 80% of them. And I completely understand why they will feel that way. For others, they see it as, well, there is so much business which is done with Saudi Arabia, both by the government, but also many other businesses in the UK and beyond have investment from Saudi Arabian countries, including PIF. Also, the Premier League have eventually allowed this takeover, albeit in a very convoluted, strange way, which still feels very unsatisfactory in terms of how transparent it has been throughout. And so really, the Premier League have allowed these owners to come in. And so it's not Newcastle United fans who should be judged for the fact that they are their owners. And everyone feels slightly differently on this. I can't say that one Newcastle fan feels like one thing or one feels different, because we all have different feelings regardless. And it's such a complex situation. And I think for a lot of people, it'll take a lot of time to process how they feel about it. I'm still processing it all. This has been so whirlwind that I'm still processing exactly how I feel about it as a journalist who covers the club. And so I don't think every single Newcastle fan who was caught up being joyful at the fact that Mike Ashley's gone and hearing these new owners speak so positively can decide yet how they feel about all of the asterisks which are now going to come alongside their football club.
Yeah, totally. And I think realistically, everyone's sort of got to think, well, if it was your club, how would you be feeling? Because if you, I can imagine what it's like to, I mean, I'm a QPR fan, so I've been starved of lots of success. But, you know, I can imagine what it's like to be in a place where, you know, for a lot of generations, some of those fans have never experienced ever winning a trophy, even getting to Wembley and all those memorable historic things. So I can imagine any kind of opportunity to experience that and taste that, you would grab it with both hands, right? And I completely understand why so many might be conflicted.
Newcastle fans did not pick this takeover. Now, in almost every single survey and poll we have, the vast majority of them have said that they would like this takeover to happen. Although I also think that question has to a certain extent been leading, because it's like, do you want this takeover to happen or do you want Mike Ashley to stay in charge? It was a stage where it would have been literally anyone but Mike Ashley. And so that there is an element of that in this. But equally, this is a transaction between a multimillionaire, a billionaire family in the Rubin family, and then also a sovereign wealth fund of a nation who've performed this transaction. Newcastle fans haven't been involved in that. Newcastle fans have wanted rid of Mike Ashley for the last 14 years and haven't been able to get rid of him until this stage. And so therefore, for to be them who are sort of looked upon by some as to how can you be celebrating this, or how can you not feel that you can distance yourself from your football club. You don't choose the club that you support. You're either brought up in that area, or there's a reason why you have a connection to that club, and you can't suddenly just switch that off, or a lot of people can't suddenly just switch that off. And so I think that that's where it becomes so complex.
I tell you what you're saying. I think where that line becomes blurred is when you have scenes with Newcastle fans holding up Saudi flags, where you have scenes with Newcastle fans, I suppose what you'd describe as Arab attire, where you have fans singing, "We've got our club back," where I understand why they feel they've got their club back, as in they've got, because they've taken it away from Mike Ashley. But I don't understand how the new owners makes these people feel that their club is back in under their control. You know, given that argument you just laid out in terms of, you know, for example, that, you know, it's complicated, it's nuanced, which I totally understand. When you have that position of "we've got our club back," I think that is going stronger and further than simply "we're happy that it's no longer Mike Ashley." I think that suggests, you know, a loyalty to the new regime, which is absolutely people's right. And by the way, my position is not to tell fans what to do, how to think, you know, how to behave. And look, like, as you said, all the relationships between the British government and Saudi Arabia, you have the British ambassador to Saudi Arabia going on Twitter saying this is good for Britain, good for Saudis, good for everyone. How are you, the lads? That's what he wrote in a tweet. So, you know, I can totally understand why, you know, Tom and Jill in the Northeast are looking at it and thinking, well, look, we're going to have a winning team. Government saying it's good for us. I understand where those lines become blurred, but, you know, I suppose I would just urge Newcastle fans to understand that this isn't an attack on them when journalists are writing about this. It's not about you. It's about something that's far bigger than that. And I think when it gets to that point, which we've seen before with Manchester City fans, we've seen it about, you know, different allegations, whether it's about high profile footballers, whether it's about links between clubs and their source of money, supporters become incredibly protective and defensive, and they almost become, you know, they start to provide the kind of, you know, lobbying and defense on social media that would cost millions, tens of millions in normal circumstances. I think that's where, you know, I would just ask Newcastle fans to read about it before they, you know, before they start going that far with it.
It's certainly a conversation that's going to go on and on and on, and one that we're also going to be chatting about in the second half of this podcast with Ollie Kay, because he's done a massive piece on that very topic.
Chris, last question quickly. If you could choose a manager, who would it be?
As I've said, the idea is it's going to be a slowish build. Not really slow, but slowish build. So do you go for someone you see being in charge in 3 years, or do you go for someone as a sort of interim for 18 months, 2 years? Of all of the names who've been sort of suggested so far, I mean, Brendan Rodgers has been linked heavily. I think that one at this stage, in my sense, is looking unlikely, but I think Brendan Rodgers would be a very, very good appointment if Newcastle could get that. Elsewhere, I also think Lucien Favre would be an interesting one, I think, in terms of someone who has experience of having been at some big clubs across Europe and developing players. I think that he could be an interesting one. But as I say, that's not me saying that either of those two are going to be in charge. I don't know who the next manager of Newcastle United is going to be at this stage. I don't think they know at this stage, which is why it's so complicated. At this, and I'm fascinated to see which direction they go down.
It's certainly going to be a drama, I think. Whatever happens, there's going to be a lot more to come. So, yeah, thank you, Chris.
Cheers, buddy.
No problem. Anytime.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
So we've heard from Chris there on the fans' perspective and the feeling in the city at the moment, but we're now joined by The Athletic's Ollie Kay, who's written a massive, brilliant piece around the Saudi takeover of Newcastle and talking about how it's just the latest episode in the UK establishment's unquestioning desire for money, no matter where it comes from. Ollie, thank you so much for joining us. I imagine it was slightly miserable writing this piece.
Yeah, you can always rely on me to sort of rain on people's parade. And it was a piece about the fact that Saudi money is everywhere in the UK and everywhere in various European countries. And Qatari money is everywhere in the UK, and money from the UAE and Abu Dhabi is everywhere in the UK. It's not just football. And my stance within the piece was that football should be different. It would be so much better if football was different, if football wasn't just sort of available to the highest bidder, like the Shard is, like Harrods is, like you know, Uber and everything else. It'd be great if football was different, and it absolutely isn't different. It's right at the vanguard of this, because countries which have sovereign wealth funds will invest in football as a means of getting a foothold in the country, because they know it's a good way of, you know, strategically, geopolitically, diplomatically, it's a very clever thing to do. And we've seen that in various cases with individuals and also with these sovereign wealth funds, of which the PIF and Newcastle is the latest.
I think it's interesting in terms of when you start to look at, you know, as I was saying before, those links that go beyond just Newcastle and Saudi Arabia. And, you know, I think Ollie's, it was either Ollie's piece or maybe Simon Hughes's piece, were mentioning Manchester United's links with Saudi Arabia. United have had Saudi sponsorship since, I think, 2008. Man United signed a memorandum of understanding with Saudi Arabia in 2017, and are involved in, you know, developing young football in the region, whatever that means in practice. You know, you then have all these different links, whether it's Uber or Disney or Starbucks, and then it gets to the point of, okay, so we know this money is in all these different places. We know that the money is, you know, coming from a regime that we don't like. What do we do about that? You know, does it follow that if you are opposed to it being in football, then you then have to not participate in Disney Plus, in ESPN, which is owned by Disney, you know, all these different parts of society that we readily use? Or is it okay actually to be a bit hypocritical and to have your line where you just feel, I'm sorry, this is too far, you know, to take, because I think these regimes are very clever. They always take a fan base that is really quite desperate for change. They did this with Manchester City when, you know, the tax in Shinawatra. And in the same case here, you know, you tap into people who really feel that they need you, who see the potential for change. And you know, that feeling in the Northeast, it's not just about the football club. It's about local services. It's about public services. It's about this general sense of being, yeah, that Brexit sense of feeling left behind, you know, that we've heard from so much of the past few years. And you can understand from a very cynical point of view why, if I have a big fund and I want to be popular and I want to build relations in the West, that I would try and tap into that populace, because there you have a set of people who are open-armed, essentially. And look, we'll see how that develops, whether there's, you know, sections of the support over time or different parts of the Premier League, different fan groups that get together and campaign against it. But, you know, I expect the football will roll on and this will just become another piece of background noise.
Ollie, you listed in the piece all the previous examples, and Adam touched on it there as well. Do you think it is a case of kind of, well, this is it, lads, and we've just got to accept the situation because this is what the Premier League want, really? And you touched on the fact that IP issues and intellectual property and rights and TV rights value was more important, really, than anything in this particular case and this takeover. But do you think this could spark change, or do you think this is just like the beginning of the end or the continuation of the end?
I don't see it being a turning point. I think it's a continuation of a really, really long sort of drift in that direction, where football doesn't care where the money comes from. The country doesn't care where the money comes from. And if people sort of raise concerns and raise questions, you get that line, you know, where Adam was talking about, you know, people will call you a hypocrite if you dare to fill your car up with petrol or diesel, or it comes back to that sort of line of, oh, and yet you participate in society. It's very confused, the whole thing. But what I do feel is that there is just not a desire to turn money away. For as long as it goes on like that, this is probably the logical conclusion would be, I don't know, Kim Jong-un taking over a club or whatever, but it's heading in that direction.
I know you say that as like slightly tongue-in-cheek, but why? I mean, at this point, why not?
The fit and proper person's test, well, what's it called now? The owners and directors test is an objective test. It's got things about convictions. It's got things about sort of disqualifications in terms of company ownership, but you can't, you know, it doesn't stop. I don't think it would stop Kim Jong-un, and it certainly hasn't stopped the slightly controversial, to put it mildly, Saudi Crown Prince from owning a huge stake in a club.
Of course, you know, the Premier League and Newcastle insist that Mohammed bin Salman does not own a big stake in the club. They say that PIF, the Public Investment Fund, is a separate entity, that they have legal binding assurances that the Crown Prince would not be involved in any decision making. How do you feel about that?
He's an incredibly influential figure in deciding where these things are, where this money is invested. In the day-to-day running, it doesn't mean he's sort of in on Zoom meetings every day and asking about, you know, how the accounts are looking or who the manager's going to pick at left back at the weekend or whatever. But to say that it's nothing to do with the Saudi state, or to suggest that he is not involved in it or whatever, it's not credible.
I think there's two things I'd raise. One is, it was a really interesting BBC story over the weekend about the UK government's actually refusing to reveal what it's told the Premier League about the Saudi takeover because it could harm relations. They did a freedom of information request because it was clear that there'd been meetings between the Foreign Office and the Premier League, and the government's refused to divulge that information. I think the other really interesting thing is from the Premier League, who were obviously, you know, they were so forthright when the Super League came along, and rightly so, and were very happy to be vocal and out there. I find it strange and quite disappointing that, you know, if the Premier League is going to approve this, I think they have an obligation, people like Richard Masters, the CEO, Gary Hoffman, the chairman, to talk to the media, talk to football fans about why this is being approved, what those legally binding assurances mean in practice. Because I think the longer that they don't address that, the more you're left with the conclusion that, you know, what we suspect is probably the case. Is PIF part of the state? Well, I mean, you only need to look at the composition of the Public Investment Fund board, where you've got obviously MBS is at the top of it, but you've also got several ministers from the country, from the government in Saudi Arabia who are also on there. I mean, the very fact it's called a public investment fund is the giveaway, and that it's a sovereign wealth fund.
Something I've been thinking about is it's really easy to get quite sort of sanctimonious, I think, about it, and sort of forget how many evils exist on our side of the world. And I think that's what I find difficult about the coverage, some of it, is that it does become a bit too one-sided, and it leans into really, you know, stereotypical conversations about the Middle East, the UAE, and you can easily fall into that trap. So it's how do you take an objective approach to it, but also consider everything that's come before, like Ollie has, and also all the crap that football clubs have had to deal with without foreign investment. You know, it's already an absolute mess, even without countries with terrible human rights records coming along and investing in it.
I can't remember if it was a tweet or it was a comment on the article, but somebody was saying, well, you guys are just unhappy because it's not just, you know, British English owners anymore. Face it, it's a world game, global game now. It's not an industry led by sort of white British sort of local businessmen made good. And I started thinking, well, that's not my issue at all. That really isn't my issue at all. I mean, Mike Ashley, who's obviously left Newcastle, if it was just a sort of normal run of the mill takeover, I would be absolutely delighted for Newcastle fans and delighted to see the back of Mike Ashley, who's obviously a British owner. He's been a useless owner, not the most disastrous owner, because, you know, it's been disinterest and coldness, and it's been cheap and tatty rather than one of these completely awful owners that you see elsewhere. But he's an owner who's had huge amounts of criticism. There are overseas owners who are praised to the hilt. I mean, Leicester's owners get huge amounts of praise. Lots of owners have got, regardless of nationality, get praised when they do things well. But the questions that are being raised about this takeover and are, I think, unique to this takeover. Generally speaking, if a takeover, you know, a club is bought by, you know, maybe if we're stereotyping, but if a club is bought by American businessmen, you think, well, that's going to just be run for profit. That's going to be, they're going to be another one of those sort of pro Super League, pro elitism, pro closed shop voices. And I don't like that at all. And I've criticized that, and Adam has as well. But the questions around this takeover are completely different, because they're questions about human rights, they're questions about transparency and all of that. So it should never come down, you know, if we're talking about Saudi Arabia, you know, a takeover by the Saudi state being a bad thing. First of all, I would say I think any state owning a football club is just wrong. I don't agree with that principle at all. I don't regard a football club the way I regard, you know, Uber or Live Nation or, you know, wherever, Disney. I don't care who owns those corporations or businesses. I would like to think football clubs were different and should be different as they are in Germany. And it's, I think it's increasingly worrying that we've gone in completely the opposite direction to Germany at a time when I think a lot of fans would look at the German model as being not perfect, but being a lot better when it keeps that club closer to its community. And that's not about the nationality of the owner. That's just about the model, which is very much about preserving the club's traditions and identity rather than turning it into an extension of a completely different entity.
I'm working on a piece this week with LGBT Saudis who are having to speak completely anonymously because if their identities are revealed, then they will be killed. You know, and I was saying to them, you know, what do you want us to do? Does us raising, you know, some of these issues, you know, from our position, which is, you know, which is far more simple, does that, you know, have the potential to cause you more problems? You know, if there's more noise in the West about this, will it mean that the repression gets easier or gets even more tough on you? You know, what do you expect to be the consequence of increased coverage about LGBT people in Saudi Arabia? And, you know, they were saying, we want you to talk about it, even if it means bad things for us, otherwise nothing will ever change. And there is this argument that, you know, the Newcastle takeover could lead to change over time in Saudi Arabia because they want to be more palatable to the West. I struggle to see it, but I think there is something in there that the more contact you have with these regimes, rather than simply saying, we give up on you, is there, you know, the potential for dialogue or change? I don't know, but I do think it's a fair debate. Even I'm still making my mind up myself about that.
Ollie, quickly before we wrap up, I just wanted to ask, do you think this is also a sign that the conversations around the Super League are going to pop back up again because there's another big player at the table who might want to entertain the idea of making a lot more money?
If this Newcastle takeover is successful, if they become a big competitive force, which is far from guaranteed, because you know, you're not guaranteed to gate crash the top six, top four, whatever, just because you've got lots of money.
I learned that the hard way as a QPR fan. At one point, we were the richest football club in the world when Mattel invested. So it doesn't end well.
When money comes into a club, and QPR is a classic example of this, you get all these people sort of flooding around the owners and in their ear and trying to get them to go for certain clients. And there's very little sort of uncompromised, unvested interest type of advice that they get. They often get very bad advice and they often get exploited. So you can get taken over by somebody extremely rich and spend really badly and end up in no better position than you were before. But what could happen if Newcastle, you know, if it works, and it might take 5 years, who knows, might take longer. But if Newcastle become this serious force, and rather than looking at six clubs that are serious about mega global ambitions and off the pitch, at least in some cases, and sort of threatening the top four, threatening Champions League qualification. And it gets this position where it's like seven or eight clubs, maybe Everton, maybe Leicester, maybe Aston Villa. And they're all desperate for Champions League football or whatever Champions League football looks like by that stage. I think that's when you'll get a situation where people are saying, well, look, four Premier League clubs in this Premier competition isn't enough. We needed a complete restructuring. And I think that is one of the big things behind the Super League push, was that they wanted absolute guarantees that they were going to have the most money possible every year. And they wanted certainty. And I think perhaps Newcastle's takeover increases the sense of jeopardy at the top of the table, maybe, if they get it right in the long term. But it also maybe is another strong, powerful voice for change, for expansion, for more of the sort of elitist things that I utterly hate about the Super League idea. I could see that sort of clamour getting louder. But to be honest, regardless of Newcastle situation, I would expect that to be back on the agenda soon anyway, because that idea that has been always in the background for about 20 years it's not going to go away. It's going to be back on the agenda very soon, I'm afraid, with or without Newcastle.
Ollie, thank you so much for joining us and writing that piece, brilliant piece, on The Athletic at the moment. And yeah, I'm sure it's not the last we're going to be talking about this one.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Adam, one more thing we're going to touch on is the reaction, obviously, from LGBTQ plus supporters at Newcastle United, as well as Pride in Football, and I think other organisations as well in the space. They released a statement, Newcastle United with Pride, the Newcastle United supporters group, and it was a sort of a hopeful statement, is what I would say. I don't necessarily agree with it, but I can understand why they were trying to take a hopeful approach. And like you said in your piece that you're working on, they're hoping for change. They're hoping this might influence and spark something. I was just wondering what your reaction was to that.
Yeah, I thought they got it really badly wrong. Where I have sympathy is, it's very difficult for what is a minority fans group, a group, and when I say a group, I mean LGBT community, that has traditionally not been included in the space of football. And as you know, it's taken a long time to get to the point where you can have a rainbow flag in a stadium or have rainbow laces. You know, let's not forget, I think it was less than a decade ago that, you know, it took Paddy Power as a publicity stunt to introduce rainbow laces in the first place. You know, it wasn't originally a, you know, Premier League led initiative. So I can understand why there is a little bit of a fear, I imagine, of going against your fan base. Of, you know, you have a fan base, the Newcastle fan base. There was a survey in the Newcastle Chronicle last week, which said, I think it was something like 95% of fans wanted this takeover to happen, right? So when you are the Newcastle LGBT supporters group and you see that, you're probably thinking, well, we can't just come out and completely condemn this, you know, even if that's maybe what they could do. But, you know, it'd take very, very brave people to do that. Where I found it quite disappointing was, you know, it was talking about the Saudi 2030 vision. It was, you know, it said, you know, things have got a lot better for women. They can, you know, they can drive now. They're negotiating with a woman and Amanda Staveley.
Felt a bit naive, didn't it?
It felt hugely naive. It felt as if they were trying to appease all Newcastle fans. And actually, the outcome of it is that you now just have a lot of news stories around the internet on pretty mainstream publications where it's Newcastle LGBT group says there's hope because of the takeover, you know, for LGBT people. And that is the kind of publicity that Saudi Arabia could never have without a statement like that. And I think they missed an opportunity. I thought it was a waste of a statement because it was an opportunity to demand increased visibility. It was an opportunity, you know, to demand, why not ask for a meeting? Ask for a meeting with PIF. No one's expecting Newcastle fans to change the world. Nobody's expecting anyone in the, you know, any normal person in the UK to change Saudi Arabian policy. But I felt it was hugely naive and a real mischance for increased visibility. I do think the Premier League now has a massive problem when it comes to, you know, the Rainbow Laces campaign. I think it's, to be blunt, I think it's fucked at this stage. When you approve for one of your clubs to be owned by, you know, or more than one of your clubs to be, you know, to be essentially be owned by a state that tortures LGBT people, I don't think you can then be, you know, leading the way in terms of saying that you're creating, you know, a safe, inclusive environment for LGBT people. I think I struggle to come to any other conclusion now than that they are, that football in the professional game in England is failing LGBT people in its current guise. You know, I went to an event last week that the FA and Premier League, I think, sort of part led along with a lot of different London fan groups, London LGBT fan groups, and it was called From Allyship to Action. And you had a spokesman there from the Premier League, a spokesman there from the FA, and they were giving all sorts of pledges about, we're going to do this, we're going to meet this person, we're going to meet that person. You know, we're all totally committed to defending the rights and inclusion of LGBT people. And then, what was it, 72 hours later, this happened. I've been speaking to a lot of people who were at that meeting. A lot of us feel the same. A lot of us feel really let down. A lot of us feel quite offended that the Premier League don't even have the guts to come out publicly and explain it, or to attempt to explain it. In some ways, maybe it's better, because we know there isn't, you know, the answer here is a failure of regulation and a desire for money. I'd struggle to see a different explanation, but it's going to be a very, very difficult way forward. And I think, you know, when you're looking to bring the British public with you on that journey, and, you know, things aren't that good, you know, things are better for LGBT people in the UK than they are in Saudi Arabia. But, you know, I still saw on social media yesterday a guy who was bottled for holding his boyfriend's hand this weekend in Birmingham. When you're trying to bring the British public with you on a journey, when you're doing that, and then your next step is to take the PIF into your arms and make them part of the Premier League, I don't see a way forward really between the Premier League and LGBT community. It's going to take a long time to rebuild, I think, an element of trust that's been broken, certainly from my perspective. I can't speak for, you know, for everyone in that regard, but I feel very let down and hurt by the way they've handled this and the way they've allowed it to happen.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think it is very concerning moving forward with the work that they're trying to do.
It's a crisis of legitimacy and credibility. You know, how can Richard Masters go out and, you know, and tell clubs how to encourage and foster an environment of inclusion when this comes along, he allows it to happen? Very, 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 very difficult. And I'm not saying it's easy for the people who work at the Premier League, because when you've allowed some of the takeovers to happen that they have in the past, it becomes very difficult when there is not the regulation in place. I read a piece the other day where other Premier League clubs were apparently unhappy about the takeover. I'd be curious if, for example, the Premier League made a proposal to include, you know, proper human rights regulations into the owners and directors test. Obviously, Premier League rule changes require approval from 14 or more clubs. Now, all these clubs, eventually, these owners want to sell. Right. And they look at the market as assets worth billions, and they might be thinking, well, we might need to sell to one of these at some point. So actually, you start to wonder, even do the clubs who aren't Newcastle want these regulations to change? Or does it limit the potential next sale, the get out, the exit strategy for existing owners? And I think that's going to be a real feature and debate of the next few years.
Yeah, definitely. And what I would say, you know, for all fans who are worried about the impact this might have on the LGBTQ supporters within your fan base, engage with them, support them, repost their content, hang out and go to their meetings. I mean, one of the groups that I am a massive fan of is the LGBTQ Spurs group, of which, you know, I think they're one of the most active and passionate and powerful as well. I think they've really united the club in so many ways and have so many allies, I think, in and outside of Spurs. So, yeah, if you are wanting to do something and be an ally, reach out to those guys and just engage with them and support them in ways that you can, and make people feel comfortable, you know, make people aware that you are supporting them. And I think that's the most important thing. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Right, that's it. Thanks for listening. To read all the articles we've discussed today, head to theathletic.com/footballpod for a 33% discount off the price of an annual subscription. I'll be back later this week with Dan Bardell, and also Matt Slater will be here on Thursday for the Business of Sport podcast. Goodbye.